Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast produced by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi. I'm the host of today's show, currently the membership secretary as well as the Boston chapter president for SimSec. Today, I'm joined by Professor Toshi Yoshihara of the Naval War College as well as the Fletcher School at Tufts University to talk about the Thucydides trap and what it means for our modern world. Professor Yoshihara, thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure thing. My name is Toshi Yoshihara. I teach at the Naval War College, and I also teach part-time at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. I teach a course on strategy at the Naval War College, and I've been at the War College for 9 years now. Previous to my teaching duties at the Naval War College, I taught for 2 years at the Air War College. So I've been in the professional military education business for now over a decade. And in both colleges, I taught the strategy course, which seeks to use historical case studies as a method for drawing out enduring principles of strategies for both mid-level officers as well as senior-level officers from 04s all the way up to 06s. My main research interest is on Asian security, in particular China's military modernization, and a subset of that, Chinese naval strategy and Chinese maritime strategy. One of the things that I like to do is to read primary Chinese sources, which I believe is a real important window into discerning Chinese strategic thought. And I've been able to crack open essentially that window by exploiting a lot of what has become really a torrent of Chinese open sources, both authoritative but also for popular readership, that I think really gives us some important insights about how China looks at itself, looks at the world, and importantly, looks at the United States.
All of those books that you've read and all those sources that you've been able to crack open, what would you say are the big ones? You had to do a top one or two that have really given you some good insight into what they're thinking.
Well, I think certainly the publications published by either the National Defense University or the Academy of Military Science, and to a lesser extent, the Liberation Army Press, I think those three outlets really have produced some very authoritative and important works. Certainly the one that has had a, you know, I would argue, a lasting influence on debates in the United States about China's military, it's the Science of Strategy that was originally published in Chinese in 2001, was then translated and published into English in 2005 and has remained in some ways the staple of the study of the PLA. Now, there was just a new edition that came out at the end of 2013, also titled A Science of Strategy, something that I think a lot of folks inside the Beltway have been reading with great interest. But that's the kind of book I think that really opens a window onto how the Chinese think about strategy, how they think about war, how they think about the conduct of wars, the waging of campaigns, and really gives an insight into how they also view the United States as a potential adversary. So I would say the previous and the current versions of A Science of Strategy have already become a sort of a classic in the literature on the People's Liberation Army, the PLA.
Oh, I'll definitely have to give those a read at some point. Now, going to the topic of the day, the Thucydides trap, which fits in with this reading of history and reading of alternate sources to make judgments about the modern day. We'll break it down first. Let's start talking about the first half of the Thucydides trap, which is Thucydides himself. Who is he? Why is he still relevant? Why do we still talk about him? Why are we talking about him today?
Thucydides was essentially a historian during the period of antiquity in Greek history. He himself was a participant in the war that he then records, which is the Peloponnesian War. It's a great power war, a massive war that occurs between the two great powers in the Mediterranean world at the time, in the Greek world, and that would be the war between Athens and Sparta. It is a war that's waged by these two powers for over 27 years, and Thucydides himself was a participant, an observer, and then a recorder of this history. And he basically has compiled a comprehensive history of that particular war and leaves with us essentially a comprehensive look at both the causes, the process, and the termination of that particular conflict. And he himself said that I have recorded the history of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta so that it will be of value for all time. And although that was somewhat of a boastful claim on his part, it turns out to be true because many international relations scholars, many of the strategic studies scholars continue to use Thucydides as teaching material for many of the IR and security studies programs, both in the United States and elsewhere.
I assume the War College, where you currently teach, and probably to a lesser extent, the Air University where you taught before, do they still use Thucydides as well?
Absolutely. The thing about Thucydides is that it's an all-in-one book. It has absolutely everything that you need to teach, for example, international relations. It is a foundational text, and many people have considered Thucydides as the father of realism. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we talk specifically about the so-called Thucydides trap. He also gets into a series of military campaigns and operations conducted both by Sparta and by Athens. And so this is not just a course on international relations, but this is a course on strategy, on war making. This war that he depicts also talks about very interesting dynamics between Athens, a maritime power, and Sparta, a classic land power. This is one of those great struggles among great powers where you have the maritime power, the whale, trying to get at a land power, what you might consider to be the elephant. And the struggle between the elephant and the whale, this construct is something that remains very useful as we think about in the past, the struggles between, say, Great Britain with the rise of Imperial Germany, the United States later on in its struggle against the Soviet Union, and now as we look into the future, possible competitional rivalry between the United States and China. And in each of these cases, we have one maritime power poised against a continental power. So this book really has a lot of large strategic enduring lessons that can be brought to bear in the study of both international relations and strategic studies. Now, at the Naval War College, I think that there's actually a very interesting story to be told. We owe a debt of intellectual gratitude to Thucydides' Peloponnesian War as the foundational text for the strategic studies course that we teach at the Naval War College. The strategy and policy department, of which I'm a member, the department that teaches strategic studies, used Thucydides really as a foundational text. And it began really in the early 1970s. And it began with the so-called Turner Revolution that refers to Vice Admiral Stansfield Turner, who became the president of the Naval War College in the early 1970s. He would later become the director of the CIA under the Carter administration. But in any event, during his tenure at the Naval War College, he began to institute a sweeping curricular reform at the War College, and that's why we call it the Turner Revolution. And one of the things that he tried to do was to increase the rigor of the curriculum in order to better educate and to cultivate a habit of thinking among military officers. The background to this revolution was that Admiral Turner pointed to an inherent paradox in war. And the paradox is that we see war repeated over and over again, how a power that is operationally brilliant, that wins all kinds of battles on the battlefield, oftentimes fail to achieve their political objective. How is it that a power can be operationally brilliant, but still be strategically defeated? And this question, of course, hung heavily over the War College in the early 1970s, because, of course, the United States had, by that point, lost the Vietnam War. And, of course, in the Vietnam War, the United States unquestionably had battlefield dominance, had won a series of major battlefield encounters against the Vietnamese, and yet, by 1975, Vietnamese tanks rolled into Saigon. And that was essentially the puzzle that Admiral Turner wanted to address and to inculcate the officers with the ability to think strategically, to think through this paradox in strategy. So War College chose Thucydides' Peloponnesian War essentially as the foundational text to think about this paradox. And of course, there are some really fascinating parallels, right? The fact that Athens sent an expeditionary force to a faraway theater called Sicily. It became bogged down in the quagmire in Sicily. The domestic audiences inside Athens turned decisively against that campaign, And Athens was soundly defeated in that expedition in a faraway land that became very unpopular at home. And you can see immediately the parallel between that particular campaign and America's failures in Vietnam. So in many ways, we owe a debt of our intellectual gratitude to essentially that curricular revolution that occurred more than 40 years ago as a direct response to America's failure in Vietnam. The course that we're teaching now and the origins of the course really is an attempt to get the students to think introspectively about the complexities of war and to the best of their ability to understand the natures of war.
Well, let's talk about one of those specific instances of the complexity, which is the second half of the name of our talk, which is the trap part of Thucydides' trap. We've talked a little bit about Sicily, but what is the Thucydides' trap itself? What are the dynamics that go inside of it? What characterizes this style of security dilemma?
The Thucydides trap is in many ways a classically realist argument. The premise of the Thucydides trap was very well articulated by Thucydides himself when he tried to essentially describe or to explain the cause of this 30-year war between Athens and Sparta. And what he wrote was, and this is to quote him directly, "What made war inevitable was the growth of Athenian power and the fear which this caused in Sparta." And this is the premise of the Thucydides trap. Thucydides tried to explain the cause of this great power war between Athens and Sparta primarily through the lens of a structural shift in the international system. The structural shift, of course, was the rapid rise in power of Athens, and that when Athens grew to become very powerful, it began to challenge what was then the, what you might consider a status quo power, Sparta. Sparta, of course, saw the growth in power by the Athenians and became very fearful. And that fear, in turn, set the stage for a series of steps taken by both sides that led them eventually into war. Now, I think what is interesting about that particular explanation is this statement that it was inevitable, which is a very important word that basically said that power shifts between essentially a rising power and a status quo power will almost inevitably lead to not only rivalry, but also conflict. And of course, we shouldn't accept that particular statement at face value. It's of course important for us to read that statement and to push back and say whether this particular axiom is in fact true for all time. Is it true in particular in the context of the 21st century?
Well, that's a very interesting point because obviously, as you said, saying that something is inevitable, it's a bold claim, especially with such dire possible circumstances and results. So if we do have to analyze it from a 21st century perspective, let's analyze it from the 21st century and also just in general for past 200 years. Are there ways that it can be avoided? Are there instances where it's been avoided? Or has history sort of validated Thucydides in this claim that this kind of rising power dynamic against a status quo power is inevitable?
I think that it's important to look at the historical record and to test this particular hypothesis, this notion that a rising power that challenges the status quo power will inevitably lead to conflict. If you look at the span of the last 200 years, you can make a case both that affirms that axiom. You can also find examples that invalidate that particular axiom. And what's interesting to note is that Harvard scholar Graham Allison, who's really responsible for popularizing this term, for coining this phrase, Thucydides' trap, argued that in the 15 cases that he's examined of an interaction between a rising power and a status quo power, out of the 15, 11 of them went to war. So even though that means that not all of those cases inevitably led to war, the majority of those cases led to conflict. And so the historical track record suggests rather strongly that the tendency towards conflict is in fact quite strong. And if we go by the historical record, we cannot rest on the assumption that this axiom will not be replayed again in history. Now, the classic example of how this axiom, this particular dynamic between a rising power and a status quo power, and led to war was, of course, the outbreak of World War I, and in particular, the Anglo-German rivalry that preceded the World War. In particular, it was Imperial Germany's rapid rise, Imperial Germany's development of a high seas fleet that according to the storyline, triggered essentially the security dilemma, triggered a response on the part of Britain to ensure that it maintained its superiority in naval power vis-a-vis Imperial Germany. And that was part, that Anglo-German naval antagonism and competition, in part, provided one of the ingredients to the outbreak of World War I. The counter-argument to this axiom that somehow rising powers against the status quo power might not lead to war is the Anglo-American model. And here we have an example in which the United States was rising very rapidly, but what ultimately happened over a course of decades was Britain giving way to, first of all, the United States becoming essentially the local hegemon in the Western Hemisphere, but in the course of the two world wars, ultimately bequeathed the British-led international system over to the Americans, without the Americans and the British having gone into a conflict against each other. What we find here is essentially a peaceful transition of power from Britain onto the United States. And so these two examples that happened essentially over the past century gives us the bookends or a spectrum of possibilities of where Sino-US relations might go. Might it go in the direction of Anglo-German antagonism, or might it actually follow along the trajectory of the Anglo-American transition of power? That really is the debate before us today.
Well, I guess in some ways it's good that it is still a debate, because that means there might still be an opportunity for a rapprochement, and you know that the Thucydides trap might not trigger. But where do you think we are right now in that continuum between the United Kingdom and Imperial Germany on the eve of World War I on the one side, and the United States and the United Kingdom, the Anglo-American rapprochement that led to the transition of global hegemony? Where do you think we currently are as far as our relationship with China's Americans, and then where do you see it developing based off of contemporary policy on both sides of the aisle?
That's a very good question in terms of in which direction the relationship is tending toward. I would be somewhat cautious in terms of directly inserting the Sino-American relationship into this spectrum of possibilities, whether the Anglo-German model or the Anglo-American model, simply because I think the relationship is very complex. Sino-American relationship is composed both of competition and also deep cooperation. The whole array and a variety of types of relationships that have intertwined with each other. On the other hand, I think it's also important to note that China has indeed embarked on certain actions that would tend to increase the fears of the United States. In particular, China's development of the so-called anti-access area denial capabilities that is presumably designed to keep the United States from intervening in crises or conflicts that the Chinese believe that they care more about than the United States. In that sense, the development of anti-access area denial gets at the very heart of America's regional strategy in East Asia, which is the ability to make unfettered use of the global commons in maritime Asia. And that because China is developing the capabilities to challenge America's ability to fulfill its regional strategy and its regional security responsibilities in maritime Asia, this is going to inevitably stimulate a response on the part of the United States. And we're already seeing that, whether it's the development of the Air Sea Battle, which is now called something else, and of course the debates over offshore control. I mean, all of these are military options to deal with China's anti-access area denial, because it is in fact essential if the United States wants to be the preeminent power in East Asia that it has access to the region, in fact, the ability to make unfettered use of the global commons. So at least in that respect, we can see aspects of growing competition, if not rivalry, between China and the United States. On the other hand, I would also caution, though, that China's military modernization, depending on how you see the trajectory of the Chinese economy, is still in the initial phases, I would argue, in challenging the United States. China is certainly not developing the equivalent of a high seas fleet, the British viewed with such alarm vis-a-vis the Germans. So depending on how you evaluate China's military power, you might say that China is only really just beginning to challenge America's preeminence and its ability to influence events in East Asia. So if you think of the Sino-US relations as a series of chess moves in a chess game, we might say that this is the beginning of the initial chess moves, that we will need much more passage of time to evaluate whether the competitive dynamics could potentially swamp the cooperative dynamics in that relationship.
And so building on that, especially with the modernization piece, because I know that's a key part of what you look at in the War College, what are the sort of things then that we as policy analysts and international affairs analysts should be looking for in the future for Chinese military modernization that might raise more alarm bells? I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of eyebrows raised based off of the construction of the first aircraft carrier and soon the second aircraft carrier for the People's Liberation Army Navy. What sort of things then should we as analysts kind of be looking at in order to sort of read the tea leaves and see if this security dilemma on the high seas is going to start ratcheting up?
I think the way to think about the things that would worsen the security dilemma, things that would accelerate the competition, really requires identifying the U.S. foundational interest in East Asia and whether what China is doing is encroaching on those foundational interests, or what we might call our bottom line in East Asia. I would argue that from an historical perspective, for over a century, the United States has been guided by two principles. And you could argue that every administration since Teddy Roosevelt has abided by these principles in guiding our policy and strategy in East Asia. And those two principles are this. The first is access. And I would define access in the broadest terms. It's not just military access, but it is political access, economic access, diplomatic access, cultural access to East Asia. That's very critical to America's economic well-being, but also in terms of its position on the world stage. The second part of the principle that's also related to the first is the prevention of a rise of a hegemon in that part of the world that could fundamentally unbalance the balance of power in East Asia. And arguably, it was the violation of those two principles that led the United States on a collision course against Imperial Japan, leading ultimately to the Pacific War, that the United States was in many ways seeking to defend those two core principles in order to assure that U.S. interests in the region were defended. And again, if you use those two principles as a way to measure what kinds of challenges that China might pose to the United States, then you could see how China potentially is already going down the road of crossing some of those red lines. So as I've indicated, anti-access, area denial capabilities, the development of a whole family of missiles, missiles that can be launched from ships, missiles that can be launched from submarines, missiles that can be launched from aircraft. They are long range. They pack a punch. They're designed to go after capital ships of the adversary, as well as the development of a whole host of naval capabilities that are, again, designed to target an enemy's capital ship. Those types of technologies and capabilities would, in a very physical sense, seek to deny U.S. military access to important bodies of water and airspace around China's periphery and also into the larger maritime Asia. And so clearly, in that sense, that too is already sort of infringing upon a key pillar of U.S. regional strategy in Asia. And I think overall, because of China's rise and its relative increase in power vis-a-vis the United States, China is already the second largest economy in the world. It has great economic and political influence around its periphery. It is already beginning the process of unbalancing the regional balance of power in East Asia. So if these trend lines continue, whether it's China's development of its anti-access area denial capabilities or just its growing strategic weight in the region, it will begin to hit on those two principles of the United States and would therefore likely trigger a response. And of course, we are already responding, as I've mentioned, not only in operational terms with things like air-sea battle and debates over offshore control, but also the larger pivot or rebalance to Asia to redress these two principles potentially being harmed or threatened. Now, on the other hand, I think that there are capabilities that the Chinese are developing that may not necessarily harm core American interests in the region. I think the aircraft carrier is in some ways symbolic of this sort of counter argument in terms of China's military modernization. Aircraft carriers have many uses, and if China intends to use the carrier for different purposes, then I think that might ameliorate, I think, the trend lines towards competition. So, for example, a carrier can help alongside the United States defend the global commons. And that's certainly something that the United States would not reject, but would even welcome. And clearly, the fact that the United States welcomed China's activities in the Indian Ocean in its anti-piracy patrols is part of this larger dynamic. Tools are just tools, right? Naval capabilities are just naval capabilities. They have to be matched up in terms of what the user hopes to achieve. And I think what's very interesting, again, that makes the picture much murkier, that we can't say for sure that China and the United States will fall prey to the Thucydides trap, is the fact that even in the military realm, you can draw some very different conclusions about where China is going. And that China's military modernization is in some ways dichotomous or maybe Janus-faced. In other words, there are two faces to China's military modernization. On the one hand, it's developing these anti-access area denial capabilities in China's own neighborhood that in a very real sense threatens America's access to the region. Yet on the other hand, it's developing a whole panoply of power projection capabilities that could potentially be used to defend the global commons, help to deliver international public goods on the high seas, much as the U.S. Navy has done over the past 70 years. An anecdote that captures this dichotomous phenomenon was in 2009. I had a former colleague at the Naval War College who was aboard one of the U.S. ships out in the Persian Gulf, and they were raising a toast with their Chinese counterparts in the Indian Ocean. Yet, simultaneously, this was in 2009, simultaneously, we had the famous Impeccable incident where a U.S. ship was harassed by Chinese vessels near China's shores. So we have basically two phenomena occurring at the same time, right, where China is exercising its prerogatives in what it calls the near seas and yet is openly collaborating, perhaps indirectly, but certainly achieving the same objective of keeping the global commons open and safe for seaborne commerce in a more distant part of the world. And so I think the larger question then that this particular anecdote raises is, in what direction will China move towards? Will China go towards a worldview that's much more congruent and in line with the way the United States looks at the global commons, which is to look at the open waters as that highway through which goods and services can flow in any direction, and that everyone has a stake in ensuring the free flow of those goods? Or will China lean more towards in the direction of asserting its prerogatives in its, what you might call, its near abroad in maritime Asia? The jury is still very much out on that question, but that also makes China a fascinating topic to continue watching and to continue studying.
It certainly is an interesting dichotomy, the things that seem to ratchet up the Thucydides trap on the one side, the other side which seems to either lower the risk of the trap triggering or at the very least is just ambiguous. So what then changes then do you think could be made on either side that would continue to assist the ratcheting down of the trap? Is it, say, China formally stopping developing A2AD technology? Is it making its military modernization intentions more clear in some method, either through some sort of signing of international treaties or closer collaboration with ASEAN? What do you see any sort of tangible things that either side can do right now to make it even stronger and even more clear that nobody wants this trap to trigger?
I think that this is a really difficult challenge. I know that certainly the United States, and in particular the U.S. Navy, has been engaged in a series of military-to-military exchanges with their Chinese counterparts. And that's seen as one method for ameliorating the pressures for competition and rivalry between the two sides. I must say that I am somewhat more skeptical about its ability to have a lasting effect because, again, ultimately, I think navies are tools of national policy, and it ultimately depends not on how well the navies understand each other, but the extent to which there is some genuine overlap in interests at the highest levels of governments on both sides. And so I think while having greater naval-to-naval and military-to-military ties are certainly commendable, and it's always better to know what the other side is thinking at the tactical and operational levels, that really only gets to the symptom of the problem, that in fact that there are some deeper, perhaps fundamental strategic disagreements between two sides, and that as long as those fundamental disagreements have not been resolved, then perhaps no amount of military-to-military ties will be able to resolve this dilemma between a rising power and a status quo power. And I think there are also some other additional obstacles that have gotten in the way of Sino-U.S. relations. And I think the one that stands out to me is the unresolved issue of Taiwan. And I think that certainly in terms of China's military modernization over the past two decades, much of it has been devoted to give China the coercive power to deal with a Taiwan contingency, and failing the ability to deter Taiwan is to fight and win a war over Taiwan. That, of course, is something that will not go away, and we can't wish it away, and that the United States, I think, rightfully has positioned itself in a way that would make the United States a potential arbiter in that possible crisis or conflict. And so even if we can assume away fundamental strategic differences between the two sides, we still have a very real problem, a real contingency that both China and the United States must plan for. The jury is still out to what extent we can short circuit or bypass the trap. I think ultimately is that we need to do the best we can, like the military-to-military relations, to make miscalculations and crisis less likely, but to keep our eyes wide open about the fact that lingering, perhaps deeply embedded differences in strategic interest means that we're never going to be able to, in some way, resolve the so-called Thucydides trap.
Well, I definitely agree with you there, especially on the, you know, the piece of Taiwan. You know, for anybody that's read the early parts of Thucydides, it's no accident that even though the fear of a rising Athens was what triggered Sparta's sort of initial hesitance, that it was the territorial disputes over Epidamnus and over Potidaea at the very early parts that were the initial flashpoints before the great power conflicts.
Yeah, and I think that raises some very interesting historical parallels, right? It was the dispute between Corinth and Corcyra that was essentially the proximate causes of the Great Power War. And I think this highlights, again, part of the consequence of the Thucydides trap is that it feeds into a series of mechanisms and steps, both intended and unintended, that could lead the great powers into war. And one mechanism by which great powers go to war, just as the Corinth and Corcyra dispute highlights, is the fact that smaller allies can entangle and draw in the great powers into conflicts that they would otherwise prefer to avoid. And oftentimes we know that smaller allies are very crafty and that it is in their interest to get the great power to be on their side and to make sometimes very persuasive arguments as to why the great powers must be on their side. And one of the calculations about Corcyra and Corinth was the naval balance of power. So if we think about, say, one of the leading regional naval powers in Asia right now is Japan. Japan's maritime self-defense force adds substantially to our ability to influence events in maritime Asia, right? It's what, in some ways, helps to tilt the naval balance in favor of the United States. And so what Japan thinks, what Japan does, will be critical in our calculus. And so, of course, one of the ongoing worries that we have is that a crisis over the Senkakus, again, something that we don't particularly attach much intrinsic value in, but Japan certainly does, could potentially entangle us in a conflict against China. Alliance considerations should always be at the forefront when we think about the Thucydides trap, that it's not just the fear and the competition between the great powers, but that the surrounding smaller powers might create circumstances under which it magnifies or accelerates the path towards a collision.
Now, the interesting thing I've also seen, you know, we see all of these parallels and all these commonalities with the modern world. And what I've also found very interesting recently is that while Graham Allison, professor over at Harvard, has been the person carrying the torch and creating Thucydides trap as a political relations buzzword, it seems that Xi Jinping, the current president and leader of China, has also been using that in some of his foreign policy speeches. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why that particular phraseology and that particular term is being used, because I know in the past China for many years has talked about building new great power relationships and trying to avoid a possible conflict, but the Thucydides trap as a buzzword has started to filter into official rhetoric. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why that's happening, why Xi Jinping is using that particular terminology, and what sort of the goal of talking about the Thucydides trap on that side is.
Absolutely. I think that it is indeed fascinating that the leader of China would pick up on this phrase that was coined here in the United States and essentially run with that phrase, and that he has in fact used the term Thucydides traps very explicitly in various speeches. I think that this isn't something that's necessarily a new phenomenon. I think it's important to put this in a larger context, that in some ways the Chinese are painfully aware of the Thucydides trap even well before the term was ever coined. If you think back to about a decade ago, President Hu Jintao, President Xi Jinping's predecessor, had convened essentially a study group to study the patterns of previous rising powers and to draw lessons from it. Ended up producing essentially a series of books that you can buy in any bookstore in China. It's a multi-part volume that essentially examines the rise and falls of previous powers, beginning, say, with the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French, the Germans, the British, the Americans, the Japanese, and Russia/Soviet Union. They also produced a multi-part documentary on CCTV that was broadcast nationwide. And again, the goal of both the study group and the products that they produced, both the books and the documentary, was to learn lessons from those previous historical experiences, examining in particular the mistakes of previous powers. And it was clear that they spent a great deal of resources to engage in this investigation. The producers of the documentary sent their folks all over the world to find the leading professors of each of those countries, leading analysts from each of those previous rising powers, to ask them about what are the key lessons. And the documentary is very well made, very slick. The folks who have carefully read or have seen the documentary can discern from themselves whether the Chinese have learned the right lessons or not, or have chosen not to learn maybe certain lessons that are inconvenient. But whether they're learning the right lessons or not, my point here is that the Chinese are keenly aware of the potential tragedies that have followed previous rising powers, rising against the status quo power, and have done a great deal, put in a lot of intellectual energy to learn those lessons. Another very interesting investigation that party leaders engaged in the past was to look at the causes of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so again, they are very historically minded. They are indeed in many ways very self-aware. And I would argue that President Xi Jinping has essentially inherited that self-awareness. And I think by articulating the Thucydides trap, by articulating a new type great power relationship with the United States, he's not only trying to identify the problem, the potential risks of getting into a rivalry and possibly even war with the United States, but then to also find a way to escape the trap. And I think the new type great power relationship, which is a interesting and in some ways controversial concept, is one, in some ways, some might argue, a woolly concept designed to address this trap and then to escape the trap. One of the things that the new type great power relationship calls for example, is a recognition of core interests on both sides, that both sides have to understand each other's red lines, and by understanding those red lines would seek not to cross them, and by not crossing them, then you avoid those competitive dynamics. But again, I think what's problematic about that assertion is that it assumes that China is in a position to ask the United States to recognize China's core interest and vice versa. It's much easier said than done. I think you can craft slogans to talk about how both sides should acknowledge each other's core interests. But again, that's much easier said than done. Now, think about bringing Taiwan back into the conversation. Think about Taiwan. What would China demand of the United States such that China would consider United States having recognized Taiwan as a core interest? It seems to me that the United States would never be prepared to accept whatever terms that the Chinese might lay out that would be acceptable to both China and the United States.
Optimism because people are learning for history, but also causes for concern because at the end of the day, there still might be strategic hard power or core interests that just do not align, regardless of how we feel about them or how good our intentions are on either side.
Right. Or that they've learned the wrong lessons or learned not to learn some of the more obvious lessons. One important, interesting segment in the Chinese study of the rise of Imperial Germany, they go to great lengths to talk about how Germany successfully engaged in a series of activities to essentially absorb the other German principalities to ultimately create a unified Germany. And yet they very conveniently elide the fact that Prussia had to engage in three major wars in order to achieve German unification, whether it's the attack on Denmark, the attack on Austria-Hungary, and then the attack on France. It would seem to me that they overlooked a major episode, which is the use of physical violence to achieve German unification. So again, we have to hope that they learn the right lessons, too, as they look at these historical case studies.
Everybody needs to do an accurate level and a, you know, acceptable level of reflection about what the history actually means and how it applies to the modern world. Now, before we go, I figured we'd circle back then to kind of where we started and talk a little bit about yourself. We've talked a lot about very interesting topics that I find personally interesting, and hopefully our listeners do as well. But I was curious, what drew you to studying, you know, these kinds of topics, whether it's China or strategic studies, certainly Thucydides? What brought you initially to this field of inquiry? What excited you? What intrigued you? And what kind of keeps you coming back and studying these kinds of topics?
Let's begin with China, because in some ways it's China that brought me into security studies. When I was studying undergraduate studies at Georgetown, my mentor at Georgetown was Professor Changpin Lin, who would later become the Vice Minister of Defense in Taiwan. And so I wrote my senior dissertation on Chinese naval modernization, in particular looking at the naval balance in the South China Sea. So I was looking at the South China Sea before South China Sea became sexy in recent years. And that's really what got me started, was really looking at China's military modernization. And then that sort of whetted my appetite, widening the aperture to look at security studies. I went on then to study with Elliot Cohen at SAIS and did my studies at SAIS in strategic studies. And I've never looked back. But I think having taught the curriculum and the course at the Naval War College now for nearly a decade, it's self-evident to me that strategic studies is a very important discipline. It's an important framework. It's an important intellectual analytical vehicle with which to get our military officers to think strategically about war and strategy. And I think what I have found, too, in terms of what drew me to Thucydides, is the fact that year in and year out, of the various case studies that we examine, both for the intermediate level students and the senior level officers at the War College, is that the Peloponnesian War is invariably voted in as the most popular historical case studies that we examine in a 12 or 13 week course. So with the exception of the theorists that we teach, that's Clausewitz and Sunzi, Thucydides, his Peloponnesian War is by far the most popular case study. And I think it's a real validation that active duty serving military officers find greatest value in the oldest war that they study in the 12-13 week, when they're immersed in a whole variety of case studies. And so, again, that really is gratifying to know that we have been using this text as a core foundational text for 40 years, and it remains as relevant as it is then, 40 years ago, as it does today.
I'm glad to hear that, both as a fellow Georgetown alumni, graduated from Georgetown in 2009, which is also coincidentally where I took my first course on Thucydides, exclusively on that book, and where I first kind of developed my love for that topic. So I'm glad to hear that Georgetown has had a continuous streak of inspiring people to get involved in these kinds of topics. Now, one last thing then before we leave, which is how we close all of our podcasts, which is, what sort of things are you reading right now, and what sort of things would you recommend to our listeners that are interested in studying more, either about, you know, your current fields of study or other new recent fields that you've started to get into? What are sort of the interesting things you'd recommend for our listeners to get out and start reading right now?
I'm kind of old-fashioned in this regard, and it very much is in line with our teaching philosophy at the Naval War College, particularly in our strategy course. And I always go back to the classics. I think the best thing to get a firm grounding in a lot of the issues that we've discussed today is to go back to the great books and to read and reread them, and to essentially draw more insights from them as you gain more experience. And so I'm sure you've already heard of these books, but to start with, I think people should read Thucydides. People should read the Peloponnesian War. Read it from the man himself. Read it from cover to cover, and spend the time to immerse yourself in that great book. there's no substitute for going back to the original. So the way that I tell my students at the War College is that we don't expect you ever master the great books in the week that you're given to read the materials. What we want to do is to whet your appetite so that when you leave the War College, you keep going back to them and go back to the famous speeches by Pericles and to say, well, what do those speeches now tell me today, now that I've had more experience out in the field or in staff work, etc. So the other classics, I would, of course, anybody worth their salt in strategic studies would, of course, recommend Clausewitz, would recommend Sun Tzu, would recommend some of the key theorists in thinking about strategy. That would include Alfred Thayer Mahan, Julian Corbett. And then in the area of irregular warfare, I would urge people to read Mao Zedong's On Protracted War and his variety of military writings. Those five theorists right there, Clausewitz, Sun Tzu, Mahan, Corbett, and Mao, constitutes the foundational theorists of our strategy and policy course. And some of them are tough reads, but I would highly recommend them to anybody who wants to have an insight into strategic studies and in the study of strategy.
Well, thank you very much again, sir, for joining me today. I had a great time having this conversation. I think it's been really illustrative of sort of the key challenges of the modern age and how that feeds into ancient thinkers. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you continue to do the great work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.